Welcome back to the Hemming Brainiac List, the podcast where we do things the Hemming Brainiac way. Today's episode is brought to you by green tea. I'm having a green tea, relaxing, soothing, warming, and slightly unsatisfying. But hey, I'm trying to be a little healthier. So yesterday in Australia we had 137 new cases of coronavirus. Just a quick update. And the majority of those were in my state. So our state, our Melbourne City, which is my state's capital city, has been locked down. And I'm in the outer suburbs, out in the Yarra Valley, but we are locked down starting in about 24 hours. So it goes for another 6 weeks. They're going to do a full lockdown. So like I can't even have a visitor, one visitor over. Proper lockdown. So 6 more weeks of that. We'd had our restrictions easing. They eased for a little while there. We were allowed to have gatherings of, first it was up to 5 people. So that was when it first started to ease the restrictions. And then it was up to 20 people could gather, so you could have a little party. And then they pretty quickly rolled that back to 5 again because there was a little, you know, a little surge in cases. But not many cases, but just, you know, a couple here and there. They rolled it back to 5. And now, full lockdown. No visitors. You're only allowed to leave the house to buy food, to go to work or to study. And if you can't do that from home, buy food, go to work if you can't work from home, and to exercise in a local place. So you can just, you're not allowed to like drive to another suburb to exercise, but you can go down to like a local park or something. You can't go to gyms. Gyms are all closed. Outdoors, so you can go outdoors within your suburb. And there was one other reason that you're allowed to leave the house. Oh, for like medical things, doctors and stuff like that, essential things. So 6 weeks of that, proper ISO. It's going to be 6 weeks until I see another person's face by the looks of things. I went today to the shops to do a bit of panic buying. as you do. Bought another case of beer, which I did last time we went into the isolation back in like March or whenever it was. And just bought so much rice and tuna. Tins of tuna and like packet rice, microwave packet rice. That's my go-to. And I put chili oil on it, and that's my lunch. That's a lazy dinner if I can't be bothered. Just tuna, like Italian tuna in olive oil. Good rice and really good chili oil. Why have I landed on that? I don't know, because it's like $1 per meal and it's delicious and it's not terrible for me. Anyway, sorry, my isolation update has gone way askew. So yeah, 100 and, what did I say? I was looking at the stats here. 137 new cases yesterday. So locking it down. And just to, not to go on about this, but America yesterday, we had 157. Is that what I said? Why do I say that number and immediately forget it? 137. All right, that was enough for us to go full lockdown. 137 cases in the whole country. America, yesterday you had 50,586 new cases. And you're not in full lockdown. I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say. I don't know. What's the debate? What's the question? Like, why? It's not for me. You had 378 people yesterday die from it. Die of coronavirus. Not, and that's not including the flow-on effect of your hospitals being so full that healthcare is unavailable for all the other things that can kill you if you can't get to a hospital, which is, you know, every other deadly thing. So, you know, if you don't get coronavirus, also don't get anything else because the hospitals are full. Because you just seem to think, 50,000 new cases per day. Yeah, we'll be fine. We've got enough hospitals for that. Plus all the other things that hospitals are for, usually. I'm sorry. I'm not meaning to shit on Americans, and there's plenty of other countries on this list as well who are mismanaging the whole thing. I don't know. From an outsider's perspective, in a country where, you know, we have 137 cases and we lock it down, to see a country have 50,000 new cases per day and not, it's really difficult to compute. It's kind of disappointing to watch, to be honest. I hope everyone around the world, anyone listening anywhere, I hope you're staying safe. And I hope you're doing your part to keep everyone else safe too. If you're still debating whether or not masks work or that kind of thing, you know what? Just think of it this way. They might work, so you do it. Right? They might not work, right? But what have you lost by doing it if it did work, you know? Just do it. Do everything that might work. All right, sorry. You don't need me ranting at you. And I don't want to harp on about coronavirus because, it's been going on for 6 months and we talk about it very little. And I like that. I like that this podcast is somewhere aside from all that. Okay, so I do try not to bring it up daily, you know, but it is also a part of our daily life. So anyway, the isolation update, I suppose I was doing that daily for a while, wasn't I? But that was more an update on, you know, my antics of being stranded in a house by myself. So I'll still do that, you know, because I'm going back into isolation. I've got another 6 weeks of full lockdown coming my way. So I'll let you know what antics I'm up to. Since we last spoke 24 hours ago, I have done about 2,800 calories worth of elliptical machining, which is about 4 hours on the like harder setting, on like 17 out of 20. That's a lot. That's a lot of calories, just so you know. I'm so sore right now. But hey, you know, I want to lose a bit of weight. And what else have I got to do? Did I tell you guys what I did a couple of days ago? I probably did. But I had to dig around under my bed and in storage around my house. And I found an old computer screen that is quite a good screen. It's, you know, it's full HD. Might even be ultra HD, I don't even know, but it looks very, very good. It's 27 inches, and I found an old Apple TV box with the remote, so you can use that to have, you know, Netflix and Prime and or Disney Plus, all the rest, YouTube, whatever streaming service you use, they all go on there. And I found a little sound bar. And I combined those three things and I rigged it up in front of, it's hanging on the wall in front of my cross trainer, my elliptical machine. So now when I'm working out, usually I'm just like watching things on my phone, which I kind of have rigged up sitting on top of the machine. Now, I'm in full HD. I got sound. I got every app on the Apple TV. It's beautiful. So yeah, those 2,800 calories that I burned were mostly watching series one of Downton Abbey, which is awesome. Really enjoying it. All right, let's actually start talking about what we're talking about today because I'm ranting and raving. And you're probably waiting for me to move on. Book 2, Chapter 8. This is the Shmoop.com summary, and I use these as the discussion prompts. Matilda de la Mole starts crushing on Julian when she realizes that she's reached the age of many heroines in romance novels. She invites Julian to attend a Duke's ball, and Count Norbert brings him. As Julian runs around, he hears young men talk about how Matilda de la Mole is the most beautiful girl at the ball. Matilda comes over to talk to him, making the young men jealous. She asks him what he thinks of the ball, and he tells her he's not sure, having never been to one before. She finds him refreshing because he isn't superficial like the rest of the party. Julian learns that there's a Spanish man at the party named Count Altamira. Oh, wait a minute. Why am I... am I reading the wrong one? I'm really confused right now. What was yesterday's chapter? Oh, come on, load. Sorry. Okay, we had Attack of the Gout. That was part 2, chapter 7, and chapter 8. All right, apparently that's what happened in the previous chapter. Julian learns that there's a Spanish man at the party named Count Altamira who has been condemned to death in his own country for stirring up revolutionary sentiments. Being a free thinker himself, Julian wants to talk of this guy more to this guy more than anyone. Matilda is very aware of how little he thinks about her, and this, of course, just makes her want him more. Man, I really mustn't be paying much attention while I'm reading because... for a second I thought I was reading the summary of, like, the next chapter, which we haven't read yet, because none of that was familiar to me. That's not good. That's not good by me. All right. Starfall 15 said, I wish Emma Bovary had 5% of Matilda's perspicacity. It would have saved her a lot of disappointments. Shall I have a reason to be less bored when I have changed my name for that of the Marquise de Croisenois? I like the French version of the following paragraph much more than the English one. It was much more sarcastic and had a sting to it. If they venture to tackle a serious subject, they will arrive after 5 minutes of conversation and as though they had made a great discovery at a conclusion, which we have been repeating to them for the last hour. Whew. The French version was more like, if they tackle a serious subject, after 5 minutes they arrive out of breath, as if they made a big discovery to say the same idea I've been repeating to them for the past hour. Swim said, the mum of fish, he said, my translation, Burton Raffles, says, if they have the nerve to broach a serious topic, 5 minutes later they are completely out of breath, as if they have discovered something truly momentous, when it's something I've been saying over and over for an hour. Jan Brunt said, Matilda has gotten more personality in one chapter than Louise got in an entire book. Yeah, this was a really interesting chapter, wasn't it? It was a real departure. That we kind of got introduced to this character, Matilda, and we had met her before, but it was a real introduction to her. And it was almost like saying, okay, this is another main character now. And we really got to sort of see through her perspective for a bit, which was cool. And really, that hasn't happened in this book until now. So I really liked it. Let's keep reading, because I'm hurting, and I want to go lay on my bed. Chapter 9 is called The Ball. The luxuriousness of the dresses, the glitter of the candles, the scents, so many shapely arms and lovely shoulders, the flowers, Rossini's exhilaration tunes, Cerini's paintings, I'm transported quite beyond myself. Eucerie's travels. You are in a bad mood. The Marquise de la Mole said to her, I must tell you that is not at all gracious at a ball. It's just that my head aches, replied Matilda with a disdainful glance. It's too hot in there. At that moment, as if to justify Mademoiselle de la Mole, the elderly Baron de Tolly was taken ill and collapsed. They had to carry him out. There was talk of apoplexy, a very disagreeable incident. Matilda paid no attention at all. It was a fixed principle with her never to show interest in old people or anyone else likely to say dreary things. She started to dance in order not to hear talk of apoplexy. of which, in fact, this had not been a case, since the Baron reappeared the day after next. And still Monsieur Sorel had not come, she said to herself, after she had finished dancing. Her eyes were almost setting off in search of him, when she spotted him in another room. It was astonishing. He seemed to have lost the air of impenetrable coldness so natural to him. He no longer looked like an Englishman. He is talking to Comte Altamira. My condemned man, exclaimed Matilda to herself. His looks are full of sombre fire. He seems like a prince in disguise. His air is prouder than ever. Julian was walking towards where she was, all the time talking to Altamira. She stared fixedly at that face, searching there for those high qualities that might earn a man the honour of being sentenced to death as they went past her. Yes, he was saying to Comte Altamira, Danton truly was a man. Gracious heavens, could he become a Danton? Matilda asked herself. But he has so noble a face, and that Danton was horribly ugly, a butcher, I believe. Julian was still quite close to her, and she did not hesitate to call him over. She was proudly conscious that for a young lady she was asking a very unusual question. Danton, he was a butcher, was he not? She said. In the eyes of certain individuals, yes, replied Julian, with an expression of very ill-disguised disdain, his eyes still glowing from his talks with Altamira. But unfortunately for well-bred people, he was a lawyer at Mary Sur Essene, which is to say, Mademoiselle, he added with a malicious look, that he started off in life like several of the peers I see here. But it is true that in the eyes of beauty, Danton had an enormous disadvantage, for he was extremely ugly. These last words came out rapidly in an extraordinary way, which most certainly was not at all polite. Julian paused for a second, the top of his body leaning forward slightly, in a stance of assertive humility. He seemed to be saying, I am paid to answer you, and I must live on what I am paid. He did not deign to lift his eyes to Matilda. She, with her lovely eyes opened extraordinarily wide and fixed on him, looked as though she was his slave. At last, as the silence persisted, he gave her a glance, like a valet gives his master when awaiting orders. Although his eyes now fully met Matilda's, fixed on him still in their strange gaze, he turned and went off with marked haste. He, who really is so handsome, thought Matilda, emerging at last from her trance, he, to pronounce a eulogy on ugliness, never of reference to himself, he's not like Caylus or Croisinoa. This Sorel has something of the air of my father puts on when he imitates Napoleon so brilliantly at a ball. She had forgotten Danton entirely. I am certainly very bored this evening. She seized her brother's arm and, to his great discomfiture, forced him to stroll around the ballroom with her. She had the idea that she might follow the conversation between Julian and the man sentenced to death. The crush of people was very great. She succeeded in rejoining them. However, just as Altamira, two paces in front of her, was stepping up to a tray to take an ice, he was talking to Julian, his body half turned away. He had noticed an arm on an embroidered sleeve taking an ice just next to his. The braid on it seemed to catch his attention. He turned right around to see what dignitary the arm belonged to. Immediately, his eyes, so noble and candid, took on an expression of mild disdain. You see this man, he said in a slight undertone to Julian. He is the Prince de Arcelli, ambassador from Dash. This morning he demanded my extraction from Monsieur de Nerval, your minister for foreign affairs. Look, down over there, playing whist. Monsieur de Nerval is quite inclined to give me up, because we surrendered two or three conspirators to you in 1816. If someone does hand me over to my king, I will be hanged within 24 hours, and it will be one of those fine young gents in moustaches who will betray me. The scoundrels, cried Julian, half out loud. Matilda lost no word of this conversation. Boredom had fled. Not such great scoundrels, replied Comte Altamira. I've spoken about my own case to impress you with a vivid example, but now look at the Prince de Arcelli. Every 5 minutes he glances at his golden fleece. He can't get over the pleasure of seeing that bauble on his own breast. The poor fellow is nothing more than an anachronism. 100 years ago the fleece was a signal honour, but then it would have been miles over his head. These days, among well-born people, you have to be an Arcelli to be so enchanted with it. He would have seen a whole town swing to get it. And is that the price at which he did get it? Asked Julian anxiously. Not literally, answered Altamira coolly. Perhaps he caused 30 or so wealthy squires, thought of as liberals in his country, to be thrown into the river. What a monster, Julian insisted. Mademoiselle de la Mole, who was leaning her head forward with the liveliest of interest, pressed so close that her wonderful hair almost touched his shoulder. You are very young, replied Altamira. I mentioned to you that I have a married sister in Provence. She's still pretty. She's good, and she's mild. She is an excellent mother to her family, faithful in all her duties, pious but no fanatic. What's this leading up to? Wondered Mademoiselle de la Mole. She's happy, continued Comte Altamira. She was happy for in 1815. At that time I was in hiding there, on her estate near Antibes. Very well then. The moment she heard of the execution of Marshal Ney, she started to dance. How is that possible? Cried Julian, dumbfounded. It's that partisan spirit, replied Altamira. There aren't any true passions left in the 19th century. That's why there's so much boredom in France. One does the cruelest things imaginable, but without the sensation of cruelty. So much the worse, said Julian. At least when one commits crimes, it should be done with enjoyment. There's nothing else good about them, and even that only slightly redeems them. Mademoiselle de la Mole, oblivious of everything she owed to her dignity, had now placed herself almost completely in between Altamira and Julian. Her brother, who, being accustomed to obey her, had given her his arm, was gazing around elsewhere in the salon, and to avoid seeming ridiculous, had assumed an air of having been held up by the crowd. You are right, said Altamira. People do everything without pleasure, and without any memory of what they've done, even atrocities. I could show you maybe as many as 10 men at this ball who will be damned as assassins. They've forgotten about it, and so has everyone else. A lot of these types are moved to tears if their dog breaks a leg. At Pere Lachaise, when flowers are strewn upon their graves, as you so agreeably put it in Paris, we'll be told that all the virtues of the knights of old were revived in them, and there will be talk of the great deeds of an ancestor who lived in the time of Henry the Fourth. If, in spite of the good offices of the Prince Andrasilli, I am not hanged, and if I am ever able to avail myself to my fortune in Paris, I will be pleased to entertain you at dinner with 9 or 10 assassins full of honours and strangers to remorse. At that dinner you and I would be the only ones innocent of blood, but I'd be scorned and almost hated as a blood-stained Jacobin, and you simply despised as a man of the people introducing into good company. Nothing could be truer, said Mademoiselle de la Mole. Altamira looked at her in amazement. Julian did not condescend to give her a glance. Take note that the revolution of which I found myself at the head, continued Comte Altamira, failed to succeed simply because I was unwilling to see three heads roll, and distribute among our supporters the 7 or 8 million that happened to be in a chest to which I had the key. My king, who is today burning to have me hanged, and was on intimate terms with me before the uprising, would have given me the grand sash of his order if I had let those 3 heads roll and distributed the money from the chests. For I would have at least won a half success, and my country would have had a charter such as it was, but that's how the world goes. It's a game of chess. At that time, replied Julian, his eyes gleaming, you didn't know the rules of the game, but now I'd let the heads roll, you'd have me say, and cease being a Girondin, as you hinted the other day. I'll answer that, said Altamira sadly, when you've killed your man in a duel, which is a lot less ugly than handing him over to the headsman. My God, said Julian, but the end justifies the means. If instead of being a mere grain of sand I had some power, I'd hang 3 men to save the lives of 4. His eyes shone with the fire of principle and scorn for vain human judgments. They met those of Mademoiselle de la Mole just next to him, and this scornful look, far from changing into a gracious or civil air, seemed to intensify. She was extremely disturbed, but it was no longer in her power to overlook Julian. She moved away in vexation, taking her brother with her. I must have some punch and dance a great deal, she said to herself. I must choose the most appropriate person, and at all costs make an impression. Ah, God, here's the Comte de Fervaux, famous for his impertinence. She accepted his invitation, and they danced. It's a matter of finding out, thought she, which of us two will be more insolent. But for me, to tease him properly, I must make him talk. Soon all the rest of those in the dance were dancing only a formality. No one was willing to miss one of Matilda's piquant repartees. Monsieur de Fervax became upset, and only being able to produce fine phrasing as opposed to fresh ideas began to sulk. Matilda, in a temper, was cruel to him and antagonized him completely. She danced until dawn and at last retrieved horribly worn out, but in the carriage her little remnant of energy was used in making herself wretched and uncomfortable. She had been despised by Julian and was unable to despise him in return. Julian was overwhelmed by happiness, enchanted unawares by the music, the flowers, the beautiful women, the pervading elegance, and above all else by his imagination, which dreamt of distinction for himself and liberty for all. "What a beautiful ball," said he to the Comte. "Nothing was lacking." "Ideas were lacking," replied Altamira. And his face betrayed the kind of disdain that is all the more telling because one realizes that politeness imposes on one an obligation to hide it. "You are here, Monsieur le Comte. Isn't that ideas and ideas which are still conspiring?" "I'm here for my name, but in your salons they detest ideas. They must never be raised above the level of a vaudeville couplet, although then they are rewarded. But if a thoughtful man injects energy and novelty into his remarks, you call him a cynical dog. Isn't that what one of your judges called Courier? You put him in prison just like Beranger. With you, anyone with a distinguished mind is thrown to the police courts by the congregation and good society applauds. The truth is that your decaying civilization prizes conventionality above all else. You never raise yourselves higher than military gallantry. You produce a Murat, but never a Washington. I see only vanity in France. A man who thinks while he talks is likely to come out with something rash, and his host gets the idea he has been dishonored. At that moment, the Comte's carriage, which was returning Julian, pulled up in front of the Hotel de la Mole. Julian was in love with the conspirator. Altamira had made him the following magnificent compliment, evidently produced by deep conviction. "You don't possess the frivolity typical of France, and you understand the principle of utility." Now it happened that just the night before last... Now it happened that just the night before last, Julian had been to see Monsieur Casimir Devine's tragedy, Marino Faliero. Wasn't Israel Bertuccio a greater figure than all those Venetian nobles? Our rebellious plebeian asked himself, and yet they were men whose noble lineage can be traced back to the year 700, a century before Charlemagne, which all the best born of those who were at Monsieur de Retz's ball this evening only go back, and even then most lamely, to the 13th century. Well, good, in the midst of those Venetian nobles so very high born, it is Israel Bertuccio one remembers. A conspiracy annihilates all the titles produced by the arbitrary decisions of society. In it a man instantly assumes the rank given him by his manner of envisaging death. Intelligence itself loses its sway. Where would Danton be today in the age of Valenod and de Renal? Not even a deputy crown prosecutor. But what am I talking about? He would have sold himself to the congregation. He would be a minister, for even the great Danton stole Mirabeau, sold himself to Napoleon, grabbed millions in Italy. Without them, he would have been pulled up short like Perichegru. Lafayette alone never stole. Must one steal? Must one sell oneself? Wondered Julian. The questions pulled him up short. He spent the rest of the night reading the history of the Revolution. The following day, working on his letters in the library, he could think of nothing but Comte Altamira's conversation. In fact, he said to himself after a long reverie, if the liberals in Spain had been willing to commit a few crimes on the people's behalf, they would not have been swept aside with such ease. They were conceited children, chatterers, exactly like me, Julian cried suddenly, as if waking up with a start. What difficulty have I ever overcome that gives me the right to judge those poor devils, who at least, for once in their lives, have dared... He started to take action. I am... like a man who gets up from the table and cries, tomorrow I won't be having dinner, but this won't stop me from being as strong and as quick as I am today. But who can tell how he will turn out halfway through a great course of events? Such elevated thoughts were interrupted by the unexpected presence of Mademoiselle de la Mole, who was coming into the library. Julian was in a state of such elation from his admiration for the great qualities of Danton, Mirabeau and Carnot, men who had known how not to be suppressed, that his gaze rested on Mademoiselle de la Mole, but without his being conscious of her, without greeting her, but practically even without seeing her. When at last his great staring eyes did register her presence, the light died out of them. Mademoiselle de la Mole saw this with bitterness. It was in vain that she asked him for a volume of Velly's History of France, which was stored in a topmost shelf, and obliged Julian to go and find the larger of the two ladders. Julian had gone up the ladder. He had looked for the volume, had given it to her, but still remained incapable of thinking about her. While he was carrying the ladder back in his trance-like state, his elbow struck one of the panes of glass in the bookcase, which the tinkle of glass falling onto the parquet at last brought him to his senses. He hastened to excuse himself to Mademoiselle de la Mole. He endeavoured to be polite, but was nothing more than polite. Matilda plainly saw that she had disturbed him, and that he would much rather go on thinking about what preoccupied him before her arrival than to talk to her. After a long look at him, she slowly walked away. Julian studied her as she went. He delighted in the contrast between today's simplicity of dress and the sumptuous elegance of the previous evening. Almost as striking was the difference between her two facial expressions. The young lady, who had been so lofty at the Duc de Retz's ball, had now an almost supplicating look. Definitely, said Julian to himself, that black gown shows off the beauty of her figure more strikingly. She has the bearing of a queen, but why is she in mourning? If I ask someone the reason for the mourning, it will turn out to be yet another social blunder. Julian had now emerged completely from the depths of his enthusiastic dreams. I must reread all the letters I wrote this morning. God knows what missing words and what stupidities I will find there. As he was attentively scanning the first of them, he heard the rustle of a silken dress just next to him. He quickly turned round. Mademoiselle de la Mole, who was two steps from his table, laughing. This second interruption irritated Julian. Matilda herself was becoming acutely conscious that she meant nothing to this young man. The laugh was to conceal her embarrassment, and it succeeded. Clearly you are thinking about something very interesting, Monsieur Sorel. Can it be some strange story of the conspiracy that has sent Monsieur le Comte Altamira to us in Paris? Do tell me what it is about. I'm burning to know. I'll be discreet, I swear. She was amazed to hear herself saying this. What? She pleading with an employer? Her embarrassment growing, she added, with a little humorous air, what's happened to turn you, normally so frosty, into an inspired being, a type of Michelangelo prophet? This lively, tactless questioning hurt Julian deeply and revived his delusions in full force. Was Danton right to steal, he asked her sharply, with an air that became fiercer and fiercer. Ought the revolutionaries in Piedmont and in Spain to have made the people guilty of their crimes? Ought they have given away all the places in the army, all the decorations, even to men who did not deserve them? Didn't the decorated men dread the return of the king? Was it necessary to loot the treasury at Turin? In a word, mademoiselle, said he, approaching her with a terrifying look, ought he who wishes to banish ignorance and crime from the world go through it like a tempest dealing out evil at random? Matilda took alarm at this, was unable to stand up to his gaze, and recoiled two steps. She stared at him for a moment, then, ashamed of her fear, daintily sped from the library. And that's another chapter down. Well done, us. Have your say about it at the subreddit. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.